In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and this is Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. This week, I speak to the phenomenal Dr. Katrina O'Sullivan.
Like, I learned in psychology that, you know, there's this thing called attachment, where we're actually born, we're born to be loved, and we're pre-wired to love as well, to look for love.
Yeah.
And like, I like to use this analogy that, like, you've got like a little hole in your belly when you're born, and it's your parents' job through consistency and love and care to like put a light inside of you. And whether it's one parent or two, they give you, through the love and the consistency and the food, I always say the food because the food's important, they give you a light.
You never had that.
No. And then that light is what guides you. And at age 5 in school, I didn't have a light in there. It was very dark. And Miss Arkinson was that first person to put a light in me. And I tell my story, and I tell the story of her, because I want teachers to know, like, they change lives. Mm. Like, I'm so grateful that she changed my life. Like, that has lasted me my whole life, what she did for me.
Katrina lives in Blanchardstown in Dublin, is married to Dave, and has 3 boys, John, who's 30, Sean, who's 18, and Tig, who's 15. And she's also a proud grandmother. She's a senior lecturer in Maynooth University in the Department of Psychology, and is the author of best-selling memoir, Poor. Katrina's childhood growing up in Coventry was often chaotic. As one of 5 to Irish parents living in a home shaped by heroin addiction, she experienced extreme trauma from an early age, which included being raped as a 7-year-old and being pregnant and homeless as a teenager. In this conversation, she speaks about the extreme neglect she experienced in childhood, the people who were a positive force in her life, the importance of opportunities and education, and the power of healing. It's an eye-opening and challenging conversation at times, so please make sure you read the show notes in advance of listening. Here it is. Thank you so much for making time to sit down and have this conversation. Like a lot of people, I've been, you know, watching from the sidelines, listening to you speak, hearing about your story, your experiences in life, and just thinking, wow, that is incredible stuff. I love the fact that you have turned your life around in such a radical way, and you're doing such amazing things, and you're a beacon of hope and inspiration for so many people. So it's a privilege to sit in front of you, and thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I actually feel the same way sitting in front of you. So it's really, really lovely to be here and to hear them things. It's funny, you don't live your life in that awareness. Like, I'm just getting on with my life. So when people say things like that, you're like, oh yeah, this is amazing what I'm doing. But you don't always live in the knowledge that that's inspiring to other people. It's just, you know, I'm getting on doing what I usually do.
Yeah, sure. I can imagine. And you're a mom, you're trying to rear your kids, and you're busy, and you're juggling away like a lot of people are. But I suppose when you take moments maybe to step back from it and go, yeah, it is something. Like,
it's true. I think every day I have a moment where I stop and go, wow, look at how amazing my life is in comparison to what it was. So like, and I actively practice that actually. Like, I am conscious of being grateful. So like, but there isn't a day where I don't personally go, wow, look at my life. This is amazing.
Really?
Which is a lovely way to kind of, and sometimes I'm reminded in negative ways as well. You know, I can see like homelessness or addiction or harshness or people struggling, and then I'm reminded that I was there. And but most days I do get a moment where I'm like, I feel really blessed. I feel really grateful for the life that I have. But I'm not walking around going, you know, I'm an inspiration. I'm just kind of getting on with it. And then, but I do get a lot of people stop me, obviously, now, which is really nice, and chat to me and share their stories, which is such a honor, actually, to hear people and to learn where they're from. It's amazing.
They open up to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you share so much of what you went through, I suppose. People then feel a connection and that sense of, oh, well, I can open up to her too, because she's shared so much of her life with me through the pages of your book.
Yeah. It's mad, because when people say that to me about being so open, sharing so much of myself, I don't actually know how to be any different to that. Like, it's just who I am at the end of the day. Like, and actually, like, how I grew up, we were all kind of like that, just outward, like, you know,
what you see is what you get.
What you see is what you get. If you do something, I'll tell you. If I'm going to fight with you, I'm going to fight with you. Yeah. But if I love you, I'm going to say it. And so,
which is refreshing.
Yeah. But and it's rare. It probably is quite rare, especially here in Ireland. I think it's quite, you know, we're a little bit more inwards with ourselves.
Absolutely. And I think culturally, we're quite people pleasing as a nation and not wanting to offend or say something that might upset the apple cart. So to have a personality type who is just like, this is me, warts not, take it or leave it. That's it's a good way to be.
And to be honest, like, I have spent a lot, I did spend a lot of time, especially when I first got into Trinity and I first began and my education, trying to be somebody different. And I just know the pain of that. Like, I want to live an authentic life and just be myself. Like, fundamentally, it hurts me to try to be different. So like, I am outward in terms of how I feel, and I share who I am, and I kind of like that about myself. Like, I think that it's a gift of mine. Not everybody likes it. I'm sure my husband gets sick of it sometimes when I'm telling him what he's done or whatever, expressing it. But he always says, like, love, you're the light. You know, you bring the light at the end of the day with that part of you. So, yeah, so I've just always been that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're saying there you feel very lucky and grateful for all that you have come through and achieved in life. But I suppose we need to also acknowledge that it didn't happen just by clicking your fingers.
No.
You put a lot of work in.
Yeah. And I was helped a lot. Sometimes I worry when we talk about that, because like, I never, when it came to telling my story so publicly, especially with the book Poor, I didn't ever want to shame anybody else, because sometimes, like, I really genuinely am not that unique in terms of where I come from. Like, there's lots of girls who are like me, who were bright and capable and had potential. I just really was lucky in some of the moments in my life that I was able to either, I was either offered opportunities and was able to engage with them, or was actually dragged along to them. So I had great people along the way who actually didn't let me fail when I really wanted to. So I'm really mindful, because when we say, like, you took the chance or you did the work, I always flip it and think, well, it doesn't mean that someone else isn't doing the work. Sometimes we can't do the work. And also, like, don't get me wrong, it was hard work. Like, yeah. I worked really hard, but like, there was a time in my life where I was homeless with a baby, and it was hard. It was equally as hard work to get out of bed then as it was. Like, I worked really hard then to actually survive. And there's some people who are just working hard to survive. And then, like, it doesn't mean that they're not, you know, that level of work is not being applied to becoming what I've become. It just means all their energy is being focused on that particular thing.
Yeah.
And like, I've learned through psychology, which is what I'm a specialist in, but also my own journey, that most people want to live a great life. Most people want to succeed. I believe, like, if people knew what it was like to be in my life, to have the gift of education and really good employment, and that they would want that too. It's not like people choose not to have them things. It's like some other things drive us. And I know in my life, especially when I've made bad decisions and done bad things, like, I really wanted to be good, but there was other things that drove me, things that I had no control over and I needed to kind of get help with. And luckily I've been able to get that help and avail of it. Now, don't get me wrong, I worked really, really hard, but other people work really, really hard and they don't get to where I am. And I think that's to do with the system more so than their own capabilities.
Yeah. We'll probably get back to this actually later on in the conversation. At this point, what I really want to do is kind of for you to perhaps really take us through the book. So there'll be people listening who will have read it, people who, you know, after this conversation will run out and buy it. But I suppose to get a sense of what normal was like for you growing up, can we go back to, you know, Katrina as a kid?
Yeah.
And what life was like?
Yeah, so I grew up in, my earliest memories are of absolute chaos. So my parents were drug addicts, heroin addicts, intravenous drug users. And so what that meant was, like, my childhood was completely chaotic. And I mean, in poverty terms, like, there's, I always like to use the phrase, like, you have the poor poor and kind of the rich poor. So I lived in a council estate where all the poor people kind of corralled together in low opportunity environments. But like, some of us, my neighbours and ourselves, were working poor, like, had shitty jobs, can I swear?
Yeah,
shitty jobs. And, you know, they were serving people and doing the best they could. And then there was the poor poor, which was us, social welfare dependent, crime and addiction and violence. And that was my life and my childhood. So on any given day, I wouldn't have food. There was squalor, drunkenness, violence, witnessing my parents doing everything they could for their addiction. And so, yeah, it was a really horrific experience to grow up in that life. Now, alongside that as well, there was loads of fun as well. Like, I mean, the community that I come from, there was loads of, you know, music and happiness, and there was loads of parties, there was loads of great things. But inherently, my childhood, especially my early childhood between the ages of 0 and 10, for example, were just witnessing absolute carnage from my parents, which was their heroin addiction, and me just being this terrified, vulnerable little girl who, like most little girls, was full of potential and vivacious and loved music and all them things, but was just not loved in the way that she deserved and cared for in the way that she deserved to be.
And obviously now at this point in your life, and you've had a lot of therapy, you've done a huge amount of work on going back through your experiences. And I suppose almost going back to that little girl and, you know, letting her know that she matters.
Yeah. I think I've spent my lifetime trying to return to 7-year-old me, because I think that's when, like, I really lost hope as a little girl. I think if, as a child, like, in order to cope, I think, with everything that was going on, I had a lot of fantasy that my parents love me and that everything would be fine, and eventually they would act like the other parents that I would see, the other mammies. And then at age 7, I experienced significant abuse as a child, and I completely cut off, and all hope, I suppose, was gone. Like that brightness that's in my spirit naturally, even now, it was gone. It was like the world is just this dark place and nobody's to be trusted. That was like literally how it was in my DNA to feel like that, not even just in my mind, but actually in my whole response to the world. And I think I've spent a lifetime trying to return to her, to comfort her, yeah, and to like heal her. And I, in the healing and the search for her, I often looked in the wrong places to try to make her feel better or feel safe. And I'm lucky now that I feel like now I'm there. Like I've been able to kind of like soothe myself and say, you know, you didn't do anything wrong, which would have been a strong thought in my mind that it was something to do with me, and you are safe. And so like, I feel really privileged to have come to that point where I can heal myself and I can love myself, yeah, as I was then. But it's still, I suppose the reason I wrote my book is I wanted people to understand a couple of things. Firstly, like my parents didn't choose to be bad parents. Like they were ill. Like addiction is an illness. Like like I'm sure my mom, when she gave birth to me, she wanted to be a good mother. Like I wanted to be a good mother, like everybody does. But like she had this illness that dominated her. So I wanted to contextualize that in some ways and, yeah, for people to remember her differently than what addiction makes you think people are. But also I wanted to talk about how it puts you at risk of loads of things. So like having no opportunities doesn't just mar how you feel about yourself, but it stops you like being able to perform in school, and it stops you being able, it makes you vulnerable to abuse, and it makes you vulnerable to like being unable to have relationships, good relationships in adulthood, and divorce and addiction and mental health difficulties. And I really wanted to explain that, you know, that 7-year-old and what she experienced actually, you know, tendrils came out from her to all the way through to my adult life. And I suppose like it was really important to me to talk about the consequences of poverty and how it really impacts upon your whole life and how you feel about yourself.
And also, I suppose, by writing the book, you're educating those of us who don't have the experience, I suppose, of growing up in that,
yeah,
environment.
Yeah, exactly.
And experiencing poverty the way you did.
Like I purposely wrote from the point of a child in my book. And I know there are some really gruesome details in my story because I wanted to actually be honest. Mm. Like, poverty and trauma and addiction are gruesome. Like my home had no carpet. There was no food. There was violence. There was the police kicking in the door. I went to prisons to visit my father. I watched my dad overdose. Like these things are gruesome. And I write about them very vividly on purpose. But I write them from the viewpoint of a child so someone can understand and be a bit more compassionate about children who come from that life. Because, yeah, often we look at like delinquent teenagers or lone parents or people in flats and think they've wasted their life, they've made bad choices. But actually, if you track back to that 7-year-old or 5-year-old kid, you can just feel maybe they had a hard time and they didn't have any other choice at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And that's my story, that I didn't have a choice realistically at very young. And that lack of choice meant that I ended up in really dark places.
But then I suppose breaking the cycle in adulthood means that you've broken that cycle then for your own kids.
Yes.
Which is really powerful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Like my middle boy, Sean, he's 18, Sean. Like Sean started university 3 weeks ago, maybe 5 weeks ago now. Hmm. Like he, you know, he didn't need an access course or like he went straight in. And like not that that's an example of success, but like he's the first one in our family to finish school at the end of the day to do his leaving cert. Like, you know, we never had that. So like, cycles are breaking massively for us and my family because of what's happened to me and what's happened in my life. And it's amazing.
It is amazing.
Like it makes me feel so proud that I have been able to like really change the future of the O'Sullivan family.
Yeah.
The O'Sullivan Brennan. I can't ignore my husband's name as well. But like change the future of us.
Yeah.
And that's such a privilege. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very powerful. I know that we've had a few messages back and forth, and I know you're mindful of the listener, and also, you know, you're mindful of yourself, and I'm mindful of you also. So I certainly am not going to get you to revisit experiences that you don't want to talk about. But I suppose just for the listener to understand what you're referencing at seven in the book, you are, as you said, you don't hold back. And there was never really a feeling at home that you were safe, and you experienced sexual abuse in its most dramatic form at the age of seven. And again, I'm not getting you to revisit this conversation because I want to demonize your mother, but I think it's just terribly sad, the interaction you had. Do you mind if we talk about that?
No, not at all. I mean, it's in the book. So, I experienced rape as a child. So, and the reason when you write your story, like when I made the decision to write my story, I was asked to write it. And I said to the publishers, I was very reticent. And then I said, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to be really honest. Mm. And that has to be okay. Because I've read brilliant biographies, but sometimes people skirt around hard things. And this particular story, I was raped as a child by a family friend, someone we called our uncle, you know. My dad was in prison. My mom's addiction was really, really bad. And as a little girl, I mean, that completely broke me. Mm. I mean, I know that like one in four adults in Ireland has experienced sexual abuse as a child. So I'm not on my own at the end of the day. And
which is very high.
It's one in five in the world, but one in five in Ireland. So one in four in Ireland. Yeah. And like Richie Sadler said a brilliant thing when he was on Tommy Tiernan. He says the abuser takes everything out of their own self that they feel and places it into the person they're abusing. So the abuser feels ashamed of themselves, disgusted at themselves, and they take all of that and they pop it into the person. And I completely related to that because I have nothing to feel ashamed of at the end of the day. No. And yet talking about abuse is shameful. It's like you're marred or you're tarnished. Now, I was traumatized by that experience and it really affected how I felt about myself as a girl and a woman in my body, which it robbed me actually of my body. Like I tell a story of how prior to that, I was so free in terms of like, I'd no physical shame. I'd lots of shame around my family, but I'd know, like I'd do a cartwheel, my skirt would go over my head. There'd be never any consequence or thought around what that meant.
Sure.
And then as soon as that happened, I became really aware of my body and what that is and what it was made for and not made for. And it was very, very damaging to how I felt about myself as a woman and a girl. But in terms of what happened with my mom, like when I look back on myself then, like I was this little girl who knew even then right from wrong. And I think a lot of us know right from wrong. And I knew right from wrong. And I knew that you were supposed to tell. Yeah. When something bad happened, you were supposed to tell. And I told my mum. I vividly remember, you know, where it happened. And I said to her, you know, he raped me, I said. And my mum said, oh, he raped me too. And it's taken me, and I was really worried writing that because I love my mum. Like I love Tilly. Like my mum was a wonderful person. She had loads of great qualities. She wasn't a great mum because she was in addiction and she found it very difficult to love us and love me, prioritize me. She did love me. She didn't prioritize me. However, like as a person who's been through recovery myself and also been able to explore in detail, like that particular incident, because not only did break me, but then what my mom did, it added it was over for me. But as an adult, I think my mom was sexually assaulted herself and experienced abuse herself. She was a prostitute and her whole life she'd been mistreated by men. And I genuinely think her response to me was just like, this is what happens to us. This is what happens to women like us. And while that's not right, and I feel anger, I still feel anger that I wasn't cared for and I did the right thing. I also have this reflexive adult now around that thought that says, well, I can understand why my mum did that. It wasn't right. and she should have cared for me and I deserved better, but I understand it in some ways.
It's amazing you have such a huge capacity for compassion. And I know from everything I've read and heard you speak so, you know, fondly, not just of your mother, but of your father also. Mm. And despite the overwhelming negatives, you can still see and appreciate that there was a lot of good there. And I suppose it was a repair that happened at different stages, particularly later on.
I think, though, with that, like, I want to be, like, I want to be afforded that too.
Yeah.
What I afford to my parents, I want to be afforded that too, because there are times where I haven't been a perfect adult or a perfect person, or I've really done things that go against what's good and what's right. And so a part of me, like, being forgiving is part of, like, wanting forgiveness for myself. But also, don't get me wrong, like, there are days when I'm really angry.
Yeah.
Like, there are days where I'm like, don't fucking mention him to me. Excuse my language.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, like, I don't live all the ways in, like, this, you know, it can fluctuate. But in general, I do have a good capacity for forgiveness now. And it is a choice, because I have the privilege of being able to understand and think more rationally than emotionally now about, like, my parents and who they were.
Yeah.
And they were complex. Like, they were great, like, great people. Like, my dad, like, he taught me to read when I was four. Like, he, you know, he gave me so much. Like, when I moved to Dublin, actually, and I was really broken myself, my dad was in recovery. My dad used to take me to the Gresham about, like, once a month or something for and he used to say, "You belong here," because he knew I was really ashamed of myself, of where I came from and the things I do. And he'd make us have tea, like afternoon tea, and there'd be, like, silver pots and a little cup, and he'd be like, "You belong here.
Oh.
You belong here." Like, wow. He was trying to,
what age,
like,
you?
Oh, I was like 20.
Yeah.
But I was so, like, this was just this chavvy girl, like, who had no manners in some ways, like, and felt really less than. And my dad would, like, we'd go and have afternoon tea in the Gresham, because he was, like, he was in recovery at that point and trying to live a better life, but he wanted to instill in me some difference, some better. So there was loads. And my dad loved my children. Like, he was an absolutely amazing grandfather, which is really hard, actually, because telling my story, like, conflicts with that.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah, because a lot of your childhood, he wasn't even really present. Because
no.
If he was there, he might have been completely out of it.
Yes.
And yet he was so hands-on then as a granddad.
Yeah.
Did that hurt you?
No, not with my own kids. No,
okay, good.
No. I think, though... I was a different person. Even at 20, I was a different person. Like, I didn't have the knowledge and awareness that I have now. And so there may have been reactions that I wasn't conscious of, but like, I never gave myself permission as a younger person to be angry with my dad. There was, like, a very difficult, there was a fear in me of him not loving me. And like, okay. So there was a definite power dynamic between us where I felt like I couldn't even say things if I did feel them with him. So like, but actually no, like when I, with John particularly, he was just so loving. Now I know my siblings felt jealous.
Okay.
And they, you know, there was definitely some like, oh my God, he's doing all this great stuff now. Where were you 20 years ago the end of the day? So that's a regular conversation that would have been had.
Yeah.
But for me, my dad actually did a lot of trying to make amends with me, especially when I was, you know, in Dublin and struggling. He was very good.
And I know that both your parents have passed away.
Mm.
Your dad, did he pass away with throat cancer in the end?
Throat cancer. Yeah, he died at age 56.
I'm so sorry, and young age to die. At that point, do you ever fully recover, get over the addiction?
I don't think he had. No, like he. It's funny because when I originally came to Dublin, my dad was sober, and I was just mesmerized by the fact that this man was now sober.
Yeah.
Because he was an absolute nightmare addict. Like, he was so chaotic and so out of control. And then in Dublin, he'd moved home And within a year or two, he'd gone to AA and he got sober. And so I remember coming to visit and just like not even knowing who he was, not recognizing him. But then, you know, when I moved here and I actually got sober myself and started on my own recovery journey in terms of like therapy, then I was like, oh, he still had his addictive ways all the way through. And he hadn't fully made amends in some ways. He did in a lot of ways, but there was definite complexities and there was definite addiction. Like he smoked himself to death, like literally, you know, smoked 60 cigarettes a day and still smoked cannabis and did all these other things, but he just didn't take the heavy drugs that he was taking before.
Mm. And then your mom, she passed away a few years after that.
Yeah. So my mom actually went back. My mom never really got sober or clean. She went to treatment. She did all the things. She just couldn't do it. I actually think she was so ashamed of what she'd done, as in like her kids. Like women are held to a much higher standard in terms of addiction than men. And like, so a mother who is as an addict is much worse, is viewed much worse and treated much worse. And so I think she had that internalized as well. So every time she woke up, she just saw this mess that was ahead of her, that was caused by her addiction in her children. And I think that was way too much for her to cope with. And so she'd go back and she'd go back.
Yeah.
But she ended up going back on heroin when she was 50. So she went from heroin to alcoholism, which is quite common. And then when my dad died, she actually went back onto heroin and died about 3 years later from her liver failed.
Yeah.
Mm. That was really sad.
Really sad, yeah. Mm.
It's such a waste of a life as well. I mean, I just feel sad that she never had any freedom. Like her whole life, there was no freedom. The only time that she was free was when she was completely out of her head. And that's not freedom.
No.
At the end of the day, because she chased that all the time. So I do feel really sad that she didn't get a chance to live. And it kind of some ways motivates me to try to live a good life and to be conscious of being happy and present and loving my life, because I don't want to die like she did. No. I don't want to have regrets and I don't want to. Yeah. But it is really sad.
Yeah, it is. It's hard for me to even know what to say, because it is just, it's just the sadness of it. It's the destruction.
I know. But this is the common, I think the common thread is poverty and trauma. So like my mom grew up poor.
Yeah.
You know, she left school when she was 12 or 13. She was beaten by her dad. They had no money. There was a lot of trauma in her family. She experienced sexual assault at a young age. My dad, he was adopted. He was born here and he was adopted when he was 5. So he had 5 years of floundering. Mm. So there was trauma there. Like, you know, addiction and criminality and all them things, they don't just emerge out of nowhere. They are intergenerational. And we generally, if your mom is poor, you will be poor. That's what the research shows us. So like she didn't, you know, become that herself. It was passed on through her experiences and then passed on to me through my mom and dad. And so like sometimes I think it's important to, like, even though it is really sad, it's also important to learn from stories like mine and learn from my mom's experience and learn also that you can intervene. Like, you don't have to be, it doesn't have to be your destiny at the end of the day. And there are things that the state and society can do to make sure that we empower women to move out of poverty and therefore have better lives, and then their children will have better lives.
Mm.
I think the sad part, going back to what happened to me as a child, the sad part about that, one of the hardest bits is I have, you know, I don't want to talk too much about my siblings, but like, there was always a sense of we're in this together. So, and when I experienced the abuse at age 7, now I only write about one experience. There's actually more experiences in my childhood than that, because the vulnerability, like we were the vulnerable children. And so when you're vulnerable, there's lots of predators that will take advantage of you. But like what that robbed me of was connection to my siblings as well. It was so awful that I was no longer part of, like in this, when I, what I write about, and not to be too graphic, was like my brother went to the shop, this incident happened. And when he came back, it was like he was a completely different person. And I was a different person. Like it was like I was transformed within this one incident from this connected kid to someone who just had no connection with anybody. Mm-hmm. And it was like I was in a little bubble on my own of fear and trauma. And it was awful what that robbed me of. And you know what? I often think, how could I have been expected? You know, when I went to school and stuff, and how could I have been expected to just perform like everybody else when all that horrible stuff was happening to me? I really don't understand how society doesn't, you know more or understand more about what happens to people like me, and then how that affects us when we go to school or when we go to play centres or all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and the next morning, I suppose you were expected to get up and go to school as normal.
As normal. Yesterday, actually, after being on the Late Late on Friday, a girl, I write about my next door neighbour. So we grew up in Coventry, and all of the families on our street, it was a council estate, but all of our families on the street were migrants, basically. So like, you're either Irish, Scottish, Jamaican, Pakistani, Indian on the road. Okay. I don't even know if there was any English people who actually lived on our street. But my next door neighbour was an Irish family as well. And there was this little girl that I used to play with. And she was the first, actually looking at her family was the first time I realised that my family wasn't normal. And I write about that in the book, like how I used to look at her mum making her soup and doing her hair and giving her a hug. And I was like, oh, why is my mum not like that? It was just like very basic. Like her mum's like this, my mum's not. But yesterday after the Late Late, I got a message from her, and she said, I watched the Late Late and I cried. She said, I cried because the memories of our childhood, but also the memories of looking away from your family, of seeing and knowing what was happening and looking away. Now, I cried so hard when I got that email because of the acknowledgement, actually, yeah, from her. But she was like, we should have done better. We all should have done better for you. Because even though we were all poor, we were the poorest. Like we were that family that, yeah, like the garden was overgrown and there was shouting and screaming. And now there was shouting and screaming and lots of gaffes, but it was probably behind closed doors after a few drinks. In ours, it was much more public. And she sent me this message to say, you know, we looked away. Now I sent back to her, I said, you were a child. And she said, I know, but the adults looked away and just left you. And that sometimes is actually harder to process than what happened to me. It's harder to process that, you know, good people or people in supports or systems actually allowed, you know, didn't intervene or make it easier for me.
Yeah. And I suppose you didn't have that awareness as a kid, but now, again, looking back, you can see that there would have been people that noticed.
Yeah. I think, like I talk about school, you know, in my book, and the wonderful teacher that I had when I first started school, she clearly saw and did everything she could to make me feel special and wonderful. And so Miss Arkinson, yeah. So she, you know, there were adults obviously that did see and did something, and she, in my primary school, actually, a lot of the teachers in that school did a lot to buffer what was happening at home. I know that they, you know, they made reports to social services and they did a lot of things to try to help us. But Miss Arkinson, I suppose, was one of them adults that restored faith for me in adults, because she was just this light every day. When I was really, you know, surrounded by darkness, I'd go into, you know, school, and she was just like this Irish, she was Irish as well, which was Grace. And she said my name properly, which is even better. You know, when people say Catriona, it still boils my blood. Yeah. It's only English people. I was on Sky News and the report, the researcher said to me, and how do you pronounce your name? I said, Katrina. It's Katrina. And then the news reporter was like, and Catriona. And I'm like, like, it's not hard. Your no, name not. Is hard at the end of the day, like Sile. Like, come on. But like, it's very easy to say yeah, Katrina. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, she was Irish and she knew how to say my name, which kind of got me on side straight away.
Straight away, yeah.
But I remember actually there was a few things that she did that I remember her telling me about where my name was from. You know, O'Sullivan, and that was like profound to me that she'd gone and, you know, it was like brilliant the way she tried to reach me.
Yeah.
But she also like, she used to, you know, send me to do jobs, which is really annoying when you're a school kid. And I was kind of, I was bold. Like I didn't want to sit still because I was traumatized. Like, and sitting still meant I was like worried about my mom and dad and what was happening at home. And she would, she'd send me to do jobs and I'd run out of school straight away. So she'd say, go down the hall and take this to someone. And I'd run out to the playground because we had a big climbing frame in the playground and she'd find me there and bring me back in. And sometimes it'd be me and my brother together she'd find. But she never stopped expecting me to be able to do what everybody else could do. She never like dumbed it down or like sat me away. Mm. She just kept on asking me. And like, I think when someone kind of continues to believe in you, even when you don't believe in yourself, or you feel worthless, like that can chip away at your own doubt. And that was so powerful. And then obviously she like taught me how to wash, you know, like I was the pissy kid, had nits, you know, I was really separate from the other kids because they didn't want to play with me. And she...
Because your parents weren't able to show you how to do this basic stuff.
No. We never had a towel. We never had toilet paper. Like, I was slagging about this the other day because my friend voice noted me and she said, oh my God, I've been out with you all weekend. We've no toilet roll. I was like, I know what to do.
Stop.
We've been here before. And she's like, I don't want to know. I don't want to know. I'll go to the shop at the end of the day. Yeah, TMI. But like,
no,
we didn't
have
to.
I know we're kind of saying, we're laughing about something that is at the time, like basic.
Basics, yeah. No toothbrushes, no soap, no. Like I basically piss the bed every night and then get up, roll out of bed myself, not change, put clothes on over the top and go into school. And my mum and dad, who knows where they were. And then you'd be smelly and no one would want to sit next to you and they'd call you names. And so I was, you know, ostracized at home and then not fitting in school.
That's awful, like, for
awful.
A kid.
But, like, I mean, even with our own kids, like, and the amount of people who've spoke to me about this, like, when I've told this story, they've come up to me and said, oh, my God, there was a kid like you. I was so mean to them. I wonder how they are now.
Well, that's the thing. Kids can be so cruel.
So cruel. But the parents can be as well. Mm. Like, I, you know, like, when a girl, I had nits all the time and I've really good hair, thick hair. They never went away. And so, like, yeah, kids are mean, though. Mean. And but Miss Harkinson, her and the teacher's assistant, I remember looking at each other and I thought I was in trouble. And then the teacher's assistant took me into the bathroom. Miss Hall was her name, and she kind of bent down and she says, you've done nothing wrong. She had a bag and she brought out this white fluffy towel and a white flannel and five pairs of knickers, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday written on them. And she said, every day I'm going to have this bag on the table and you're to come in here before school and this is how you wash yourself. And like, I felt
so lovely,
really ashamed in that moment. I already knew that I was the pissy kid. I already knew that my family were the bad family, but I appreciated the help.
Okay, yeah. So, because even though it was an incredibly kind thing to do, it was also mortifying for you.
It was. I was ashamed, but also she hunkered down in front of me and looked me in the face and was like, you have done nothing wrong.
Okay, yeah.
And like, to hear that is lovely. Mm. Even though, you know, you're like, oh, because you want to defend your parents as well. You want to protect them. I knew that they weren't doing a good job. I knew that this is what this meant. Even like very immaturely, I knew all that, but I wanted to protect them. But also was so glad that somebody was seeing me and like helping me.
Yeah,
like I needed to be helped. So like, that was great. And then Miss Arkinson would always bring in like clothes and, you know, old clothes. She'd be like, oh, I found this old dress. I'm sure she was out like buying shit for me. You know, I'll never forget this blue velvet with a white collar dress that she gave me. It had little buttons down and I just felt so pretty in it. And I wore it until it was too small. And I remember my mom gave it away to one of our friend's kids and I was fuming. Yeah. Like, that was my, even it didn't fit me anymore. Yeah. But, you know, like I use this analogy, like I learned in psychology that, you know, there's this thing called attachment where we're actually born, we're born to be loved and we're pre-wired to love as well, to look for love.
Yeah.
And like, I like to use this analogy that like, you've got like a little hole in your belly when you're born and it's your parents' job through consistency and love and care to like put a light inside of you. And whether it's one parent or two, they give you through the love and the consistency and the food. I always say the food because the food's important. They give you a light.
You never had that.
No. And then that light is what guides you. And at age five in school, I didn't have a light in there. It was very dark. And Miss Atkinson was that first person to put a light in me. And I tell my story and I tell the story of her because I want teachers to know like that they change lives. Mm. Like I'm so grateful that she changed my life. Like that has lasted me my whole life, what she did for me.
Can you imagine? I don't know, you don't want to imagine because it was such a positive in your life, but had she not been there?
Yeah. I can imagine because I can see it in siblings and I can see it in friends.
Okay.
The consequence when it isn't there.
Yeah.
And like I've had lots of messages from people who say I never had any of that in school and the damage of having like the harsh experience in education. So I can imagine that, but I can't imagine it for me. I think the warmth that I feel and I have definitely comes from that like very early, a really positive experience with somebody in school. And I remember like, so our house was really crazy. It was very scary. And sometimes I'd be lying on my bunk bed and some of the crazy stuff would be going on and I'd be really terrified. And like, I'd be like grappling in my mind. I don't know if you've ever experienced that, but when you're in a real stressed state or depressed state, and I'd be grappling for like some hope or something. Yeah. And she would come to mind. She, like, even in the dark times in my childhood, I remember she thinks I'm something. I can pop in. So like, all the way through nursery and then all the way through primary school, I'd go to the nursery every morning. Me and Darren, my brother, we went every morning to the nursery before school. Every single day we went in, she was there, she'd give us a bun, oh, we'd have a drink and then we'd go over.
So it wasn't just a year in life, it lasted.
All the way.
Yeah. Did she know the impact she had on
she
you?
She does know, like I've spoke to her, like I'm going to meet her soon. She's here in Ireland. Oh, she's amazing. Home. Yeah, she came home. I was meant to go 2 weeks ago, but I got a chest infection so I couldn't go up. So I'm going to go, but she's, oh my God, like she follows me on Facebook and she's just like exactly the same. She's like, I'm so proud of you. Mm-hmm. And her nieces and her family have been in touch. So her daughter is actually a principal of a school in England. And they all message me and be like, oh my God, thank you. What's weird is like other people who were in her class as well, they all are like, oh, she was great to me. And I kind of feel a bit jealous. It's like
she was mine,
but I think she was great to everybody at the end of the day. But yeah, so we're in touch and it's amazing.
When was the last time you saw her?
Oh, when I was, oh God, probably I was about 10.
That'll be powerful. It
will. It? Yeah. It'll be really powerful. Yeah. To go and see her. Wow. I'm a bit nervous about it too. You know, sometimes they say like, don't meet your heroes. So like, because you know, with teachers, like you don't really know what they're like. You just know what you know. Mm. It's a bit nerve wracking as well.
I would imagine it's nerve wracking for her too. But also I would imagine the sense of satisfaction she must feel knowing that, you know, she was such a positive force in your life.
Yeah.
And she must be really proud of you and what you've done with your life.
Oh, she is. And she's messaged me. And what's lovely as well is that she remembers so many details from my childhood and from like about my siblings. And like she's asked me questions. I'm like, oh my God, like she really knew me and she really knew, which is so lovely to actually be, to know that I, you know, and she was like, you were always so special. They were always so special, you know. And for me, I think of myself as being like this naughty, reactive little kid, because like you could ask other teachers and they would say that's what I was. Like,
but she could see beyond that behavior and see you.
Yeah. And I think that's so important in education, is that we really try to see beyond how kids present themselves. Mm. Like no kid is going to come to class and be really naughty just for no reason at the end of the day. Of course. There's always a reason. And I think education is our responsibility to actually try to reach people and adjust ourselves rather than asking them to adjust to us. Mm. Mm.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
She wasn't the only teacher that ended up being a really positive influence in your life, Mr. Pickering.
Yeah. So he was a different kind of story. So I was a teenager when I went into his class, and I was then, I love to say, like, Miss Harkinson just loved me, and then I just turned into this amazing kid. No, that's not what happened. Like, what she did positively influenced me, but like, I was this rebellious teenager, you know.
But you still had the same home environment.
Crazy. And like, you know, we used to, you know, like, my parents would take you out robbing with them. Like, it was really, like, really bad. It was like what you imagine. It's like what you see on Shameless is what happened in our house. Like, it's real, that. And so, like, but when I went into secondary school.
And what are you talking about? Like, going into a shop?
Shoplifting, or my dad did credit cards and he'd bring me with him as a cover.
Right.
Or there was friends of ours used to go, like, that was their job to shoplift. Like, actually their job.
Okay.
So come, and I know.
Shouldn't laugh.
I know, but it was. And so, like, sometimes they'd ask my dad or my mom, could they take me? Because I was a good decoy, like, having a child with
them. Having a cute kid.
Yeah, exactly. And then, like, when I got older, it was, like, robbing cars or being with the gang that robbed cars. I always wanted to go out with the coolest boy, and he had to be the baddest boy, because that's how I felt about myself and what I deserved. But, I mean, I know a lot of women can identify with that. But in my case, I think it was much deeper rooted in trauma.
Yeah.
But like when I was, so as a teenager, secondary school, like you turn into this really rebellious teenager. But I also wanted to be good. Like, I was a really good reader and I read avidly, but like, that's not cool. So none of my friends knew that I read a lot, but I would read a lot.
Okay.
But when I went to secondary school, Mr. Pickering was my English teacher. And I think he just knew. There was one incident where my best friend, she got her mom to do her homework for her. And he said to me, he said to my feedback was, maybe you should ask for Louise for help. So I went up to him and I was like, her mom did her homework. That's why it was so good. And I think he realized that I wanted to do well. I think that incident might have actually shown him that I cared.
Yeah, I get
I wasn't just this wild, naughty girl who was hanging out smoking. Mm. And so he actually told me his life story. That changed my view of him. So he told me he was a minor. He left school at 15. He became a minor. And then he went back to university, Open University, when he was in his 30s. And I was like blown away that actually a teacher was a human. First,
yeah.
Because you know yourself, like I used to think they were just like authority and I hated them at that age.
And we never imagined their life outside of the classroom.
No.
Yeah.
That he was married and he had daughters and all this stuff. And so like that kind of got me on board. And then like he used to say like same thing, like to come and help me do a job at lunchtime, but he'd have a bit of soup and he'd give me a bit of soup. And then he used to sneak me books. So like he used to give me Of Mice and Men and, you know, I used to love reading out loud in his class. Like I wouldn't do that in any class because it wasn't cool. But in his class, I was like, me, pick me. He just had this way of making you want into work. But he did this amazing thing for me when I was in 14 and it was parent teacher meeting. My parents never went because they were ashamed and they didn't want to face schools, you know. And I remember he knocked my front door and I answered and I thought, oh shit, I'm in trouble, because a teacher comes to the door, you're in trouble. And I knew my mom and dad would be fuming. And he said, is your dad there? And I called my dad. My dad came to the front door and I listened behind the door because I was like, what did I do? And he said, Miss O'Sullivan, it was parent teacher meeting. I was hoping to see you tonight. My dad kind of mumbled an apology because he was embarrassed. Mm. He wasn't like a shameless character, like this aggressive man. He knew like he was living a shit life and he didn't want to see people like him. And Miss Pickering said, I just wanted to tell you like that your daughter is amazing. She's really talented and so much potential. And I think you should be ashamed of yourself for not helping her more.
Wow, yeah.
And my dad apologized and like mumbled something about doing better. But like behind the door, I like grew. Another light was placed in me in that moment. Like some teacher who didn't have to do what he did, went out of his way, went to bat for me, this little crazy chavvy teenager who was delinquent. And I was like, I know I'm good at that. And that's powerful.
Yes, yeah.
But the truth is, though, you know, and this is the other message that I had for teachers, really important messages, like sometimes no matter what you do, it's never going to, you might not get the outcome that you are hoping for. So like teachers work really hard to keep kids in school and they work really hard for them to do well in their exams. But sometimes something else is driving the child and you no matter what you do, they're not going to perform. And like within a year I was pregnant and I'd left school. And like Mr. Pickering could have thought he failed. But like, I don't know if he ever knew that light he placed in me well guided me way beyond the moments. Like, and at 23, when I was actually in Trinity in an interview for a place in Trinity College, what he did then at age 14 came alive in me. Because when they asked me about books, because I was floundering in this interview for the Trinity Access Program. Mm. And when they asked me about books, I knew then. I was like, oh no, I'm good at this. Because Mr. Pickering told me I was good at that. And he came to my house and he told my dad that I was worth something. And so in that moment, it was like his light, his belief, his everything came to life in me. And I was able to fight and get a place on the program. And I think, you know, for teachers, if they do listen, like sometimes you have to just believe that moment, that investment in that moment is enough and not always expect kids to do well, but not like be disheartened if it doesn't work. Because he never knew. He died.
Yeah.
He never knew.
He never knew.
Mm. He was an amazing man.
Hopefully, on some level, he knew.
Yeah.
I hope he did.
Yeah.
Because what a great person. Mm. And it's true, isn't it, what they say, like the impact we have on others is more important than anything else. Mm.
Yes.
We can have loads of money in the bank or we can achieve, you know, great accolades in our career, whatever it is. But really, it's the impact we have on the people we interact with, whether they're in our close family circle or whether they're somebody like that we interact with for a short period of time, but it stays with the person. It's huge.
It's always in the moments for me. Like, so in the last, you know, obviously since the book's come out, there's so much wonderful stuff has happened.
Mm.
you know, and you could get lost in that. But like, I it's the individual investment that matters. Like, I got an email yesterday from a student who, she just said, like, you made me want to come to class. And I'm like, that's what matters.
Yeah.
You know, they're the things that matter, not this big achievement. This, obviously, I'm a doctor in psychology. Wow. Yeah. Like, I have a PhD from Trinity College. That's amazing. Don't get me wrong. From
it's a
15,
bit of a big deal.
It is a big deal.
Just a bit.
But you can't live your life in that moment all the time, but you can in the positive relationships with people.
Yeah.
You can in that. I think they're the things for me that if I focus on them, I'm always feeling like I've achieved something. Like, I mean, I don't walk around go, you know, there's not like a sign on me where it's like, oh, Mary Robinson gave me my PhD from Trinity. Yeah, it's amazing. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
But like, it doesn't actually fill you up like with esteem. It just is an achievement. Whereas relationships, I think, are important.
Yeah. The photo that I've seen a lot is the photo with your folks, obviously, and you're in the full regalia.
Yeah.
Is that the day you graduated?
That's one of my three. One of my three graduations.
Pick which one. What was that like for your folks?
Oh, that was... So my dad was this... Yeah, so it was a mixed bag.
Okay.
So like my mum was really uncomfortable. Like really uncomfortable that particular day. So the first graduation was from... So for anyone who doesn't know my story, basically I went from... 15, homeless, had a baby at 16, pregnant, council flat, social welfare, no hope. And then I luckily got into Trinity College when I was 23 through the Trinity Access Program.
Yeah.
Living in Dublin 1, had loads of support in Dublin 1 and got into Trinity. And so, yeah, and what I learned in Trinity was that I'm actually really intelligent.
Yeah.
And I never knew. And such a sad fact that I didn't know. I knew I was good at English because Mr. Pickering had told me, but everything else I didn't. I knew I was smart. I'd buy and sell you, but I didn't know I was book
smart. You were street smart.
Yes.
That's what you were aware of.
Yeah. I didn't know I was book smart.
Yeah.
And when
that's a different animal.
It's so
being different. Academically minded.
Oh, it is. But I think they're like, I told this story to Ray Darcy the other day. Like I was chatting to him about something and I said, like my street smart helped me with my book smart. So I remember in one class, I used to statistics and psychology, which I really struggled in at first. I used to be looking at the lecturer and I could tell when his in tone would change around certain topics, right? So I used to be like, oh, because I had to be savvy when I lived on the street.
Mm.
And I used to be like, oh, he's going to examine us on that.
Okay, wow.
So right. I used to, like, I had a special pen in his class. So his name is Michael Gormley. He's my actual PhD supervisor. So I had a special pen, a green pen, and I used to highlight things. I'd be like, right, he's going to ask that.
Uh-oh.
He's going to ask that. And then the rest of the class, we'd chat and I'd be like, he's going to ask us about this. And they'd be like, how do you know? I'm like, oh, trust me. And then after the exams.
They were like, you're right.
Oh, yeah. Because I had like an instinct for people that came from fear, but also having
survival.
To be survival.
Right.
And that helped me. So it really helped me like in terms of my study and in terms of planning.
The edge.
Yeah, and the edge. But also I think like achievement, you can become addicted to achievement as well. Like I was way over the top in terms of like, I need to do well. I need to do well. I need to do well.
So you weren't going to, it was all or nothing.
No, it was all,
like, and do you feel, because I know obviously, and you touched on it earlier in the chat, like, you know, so your parents were addicts and you yourself then, you know, had a period where you had to get sober. So
yeah.
Did you feel like there was a moment for you or moments where you could have gone down a similar path in terms of your own addictive
traits? Oh, I definitely
traits?
Did. So like there was a period when I lived in Birmingham before I moved back to Dublin where my house was, squalor as well.
Okay.
Electricity, not looking after my son properly. It's my biggest regrets that I couldn't actually be the mother I wanted to be for them first couple of years. Now I was then and I've raised an amazing man and
sure.
He's fantastic. But like...
And you're also a kid still at
kid,
this point.
Exactly. I do have compassion and love for myself then. But also like me, he deserved better at the end of the day, irrespective of, we all deserve to have a loving home and
sure.
The right parents. So, you know, it's not to not acknowledge that as well.
Okay, yeah,
but yeah, so I did have a very dark 5 years. And then I was so lucky, like in Dublin back then, there was so much investment from the Celtic Tiger in poverty. Like it trickles down. So like there was loads of opportunities for poor women. So like the first thing that changed my life was actually therapy. So there was a local guy and he used to sit in this little room down in Summerhill and you'd pop in for a cup of tea and have a smoke and a chat with him. And one day I went in, I used to chat to him. I said, Joe, like I'm what is this? And he'd be like, you need therapy, like. And I'd be like, I'll do anything, because I felt broken a lot. Mm. And so within a few days, I was in front of a counsellor. Like, there was no waiting list. It was free.
Yeah.
It was so. And so I really, really believe that we need to do better when women ask for help, particularly women like me. We need to give it them now, because it changes everything. Like, and so, yeah, there was a really strong, there was a definite period of like being broken too. And then actually finding my own way out of the darkness.
And that was through the therapy, I suppose.
The therapy was the most important thing. Like, education came second, therapy came first.
Yeah.
Like, personal and commitment to therapy. Like, if we talk about anything that I did, like, I kept going back to the therapy.
Yeah, even though it was hard.
Even though it was hard. That was the biggest thing that I did, was I kept committed to that, and I kept committed to myself
doing
in that. Like, that was the bit, rather than the hard work in education and all that stuff, that which is great. But actually going back to therapy over and over again was really important. And like, back to the graduation, like,
yeah,
my mom was so she'd actually just relapsed just before, horribly for me as an adult then in my own journey, while I was like, you know, escaping and moving on, I couldn't, because I was so embedded still in my family.
Yeah.
And so like, my mom, like, often a lot of my memories of the joyful periods are marred by relapses and car crashes. And my mom had a liver transplant, and she got, so this particular day when I graduated, my mom had just relapsed, and then she was back from a relapse, and she was terrified being in Trinity. She just felt completely like she didn't belong there. Mm. She didn't belong there, to be honest, like, because it's not made for people like my mom. And she just felt, whereas my dad was like this bravado man, like, he'd take on his, like, he'd put on a Crombie and he'd be like,
okay, act the part.
Oh, yeah, the Gresham, like,
he grew up
in Clontarf, like, he had all of the patter at the end of the day. So he was like lording it.
Yeah.
And my mom was like hiding in the corner. And there's me, like, looking at them, terrified,
okay,
because no one knew, my students knew any of my background, because I didn't really want to tell them.
Okay, yeah.
So like, it was really, really weird. And then Dave was there.
Were you able to be present and enjoy the moment, or were you just constantly worried about them?
No, I was worried about them.
Yeah,
I was worried about them. And then, but Dave was there, so I had a baby in second year. Like,
So let's talk about him, because obviously a huge part of your life.
Yeah,
you meet him.
Yeah,
and then you have two other boys in the mix later on.
Yeah.
So Dave is your husband, David.
Yeah, Dave's my husband. Yeah, so like, that's the biggest, I think the best achievement of my whole life is having learned to love and be loved. I feel emotional saying that, but like, I didn't think that I was lovable and that anybody would ever love me. And that was really from my childhood. Like, there was this deep feeling that was something wrong with me and that I wasn't ever going to be able to connect with another human being. And for a long time, I couldn't, because of the trauma and the things that I was carrying. After being in therapy, I just met this wonderful man, like, who is on a journey of recovery as well. Like, I met him through recovery. But Dave is just this, you know, he's just this really committed, like, we just have the same value. Like, we wanted to have a lovely family. And we wanted, like, we don't drink and we don't party. We talk a lot. Now, I talk a lot more than him. And he's really handsome as well. Oh. But, like, we regularly decide to keep loving each other.
Mm.
And, like, for me, that's my success.
Yeah.
And so I met him when I was just at the end of first year and got pregnant pretty quickly and had Sean then in second year and continued on, never took a break. But Dave has just turned in. So like at the...
Yeah, like never took a break in the sense that when I read this. So like, okay, so you gave birth and then like... Tell us what happened.
Okay, so like this is, I don't recommend this for other women.
This is a
bad thing.
Yeah, this is not maternity leave.
No.
People.
So, but no one ever told me to take maternity leave, to be honest. So I had Sean on February the 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did my exams in the May.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, Sean was like the easiest baby ever. If it had been Tig, I definitely wouldn't have been able to do that, because Tig was a different kettle of fish. Sean slept a lot. He drank a lot of milk, slept a lot, and he was very easy. There was one actually day, so I'll never forget Amy. One particular day we had an exam and the time was changed. And I had Sean and I had him minded for the 2 hours of the exam. And then it got changed really last minute. And Amy Brogan, thank you, Amy. She actually took Sean for the 2 hours that I did my exam. But like, this isn't a good thing. Like, this is a trauma thing.
Okay.
Like, not knowing your limits.
Right, yeah.
Just keeping going and not listening to my body at times has been a journey, and it's still a journey that I'm on.
So that was a form of addiction.
Addiction, yeah. But also I was like, I just don't want to, I don't want to put this off. Like, this is, I loved college. Mm.
Like, and because you were good at it.
I was good at it, but people used to piss them out. Like, I was like, I was cleaning toilets like the year before in Connolly Station. And so it was deadly. So I didn't want it to end. Mm. But like the graduation piece, like I got a first, by the way, overall. So the graduation was like, my mom was there, but I remember, and Sean was there, my middle son, and Dave. And I remember the two of them sides of my family, like my future and my past, standing side by side. And so I could choose to look at the love, because he was so full of love, Dave, even though Trinity was never in his future or whatever. Like, he was just full of love and admiration.
Yeah.
So at the graduation, while I was conscious of my mom, I could just see him and the future with him. And it was gorgeous. And I remember the woman who ran the access program, she kind of sidled up to him and she's like, you better look after her, because she hadn't met him before, because all the tap come, they all come when you graduate, the Trinity Access Program people. And she sidled up to Dave, and he didn't know who she was, and he was like, who the hell is she? And I was like, don't mess with her, she's minding me. And he said she just warned me that I better not let you down. It's been a wonderful journey with him, and being a mother in a different way, and you know, just being present with my children just makes it life so much better, so much easier.
Yeah.
Like, I've learned that like stability and commitment and consistency is actually sometimes the solution to anxiety for me, or like insecurity. It's like having a safe home, getting the shopping, having a, you know, making a dinner. Please don't think that I'm like not a feminist. I am a feminist. He makes the dinner more than me. But like, all them things are like actually the things that ground me.
Sure, yeah. Mm. And you know what? You know, even if you came from an air quotes normal background, they're the things that matter, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. But we live in a world, they tell us so much different. Mm. Like, the world tells us that, like, you know, career or how you look or all these things are like the mark of success. But like, generally, I think like we sit down most evenings together, the family, the four of us, and have dinner together, like most evenings. And sometimes, like, I don't have any interest in what they're talking about because it's Man United most of the time. But like, the fact that we sit and together, and you know, there's love there, and that's happiness.
And that's a serious achievement, especially when the boys are the age they are, like 15 and 18. They're usually at the age where they're like, you know, good luck to this.
No, don't get me wrong. I'm forcing them down to the table. They're not whistling in. We're not the Waltons. They're like, oh, hi, ma'am, how are you? No, it's not.
They
that.
Know it's important to you.
They do, but they love the connection too.
Yeah, like, great.
We do have a good. A good old bond in the house.
So not alone are you a mother of three, you also have
a grandson.
A grandson.
Oh my God, the light of my life.
How old is he now?
He's 19 months. He's 19 months. But it's funny.
Magic.
Because you have to be careful what you say when you're the granny, because you're like, oh, it's a love like you've never known. But that doesn't mean I don't love my children. But it's like...
But I see it with, you know... As in, we have two kids and we're blessed that those two kids have their grandparents on both sides.
Yes.
Which is really quite something.
Yeah.
And we see the adoration that both sets of grandparents have for those kids.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Well, we're the same. Like, me and Dave compete to spend time with him. Like, honestly. And like, if Dave's with him, he'll send me a photo.
I'm here.
Sometimes like John and Dave will have a coffee and he'll bring him along. And Dave will send me a photo. I got my hug in today. So like, it's definitely one of the, and like, I mean, John's girl and their family, they're beautiful people.
Mm.
Like, so, like, from this reflective piece, when he told me he was pregnant, like, they're together 15 years, like, they're a long time together. But I couldn't ask for a better person for him to be in love with and for them to have a family. They're just so wonderful. So it's like, not only have we healed and have things changed, but like, the life of John and his future family are also changed. And it's just wonderful to be able to have that ability to look at it like that. But he's just the best. I think he's the best child in the world. Mm. Like, and I would argue anybody. I would argue with anybody over that. So he's amazing. Yeah, he's really amazing.
Writing the book was obviously a huge experience for you on a personal level. And then it has that domino effect of having a positive impact on those who read it. Those who just feel inspired, very moved by what you're saying and what you've gone on to do, but also those who perhaps are coming from a perspective of lack as well. Mm. What would your last words be to maybe somebody who felt drawn to this conversation, to hear you speak, who maybe is struggling, who is in a... And I don't necessarily mean coming from poverty alone, while that obviously is an aspect, but somebody who feels... that there's more to life than what they're currently experiencing. Mm.
I often say to people, like, it's not your fault. Like, I walked around for a long time thinking it was my fault that I wasn't doing the good things or hadn't achieved. The privilege of education showed me that a lot of things are predetermined for us, and society and what we experience in the world actually really influences who we are and what we become. Like, the things that helped me is asking for help, like, literally, you know, and that can be in all different guises. If it's emailing me or it's popping into, you know, a counselor or whatever it is, I think sometimes we can't change our life on our own, and it's good to know that it's not your fault, and maybe to just reach out in whatever guise it might be if you do want to change your life. And it hasn't always been easy for me. Like, it's easier now for me to tell the story, but there were times where it was very difficult. And, like, getting help was the one thing that actually, you know, getting help from other people was the thing that moved me along. But I do really believe that, especially people who have come from adversity, have had trauma, or live in areas or in places where there's lack of opportunities, a lot of that has nothing to do with them. And I only learned that later on. It wasn't really my fault. And I walked around a lot of the time thinking it was because I didn't do the right thing. I didn't work hard enough, or I didn't choose the right things. And now I understand actually there's so much more that contributes to that. And And I always think, like, there's always another day. There's always another day to try and do whatever it is that you wanted to do or you think you might want to do. What's been wonderful is the amount of women that have emailed me and said, I'm actually going to do that course. I'm actually going to try. I'm actually going to do that course, you know, and that's like, oh, yeah, just try it, you know. Sometimes failure isn't a bad thing either. You know, like, we often nowadays, like, you can't fail. Like I failed a lot, and I think it's okay to just not be great at everything, and sometimes not fail, and sometimes fail and then try again. I don't have all the answers. I do know, though, that help, asking people for help, was probably one of the most important stepping stones for me to actually get to where I am today, not trying to do it on my own, not blaming myself, and then asking for help.
Yeah. Katrina, it's been really amazing to meet you.
Yeah.
You too. And talk to you. You're just an incredible human being, and you're really cool and funny. And
I am funny.
Yeah. I know a lot of this chat is
Dave doesn't think I'm funny.
I can tell. I'd say you're a pure messer.
Yeah, I am. I am a bit of a messer.
Yeah, I mean, what you've done as well academically is it makes me, as somebody who doesn't have an academic background, it feels not insecure, but I'm just in awe of you. I think it's amazing. But I love how you wear it so lightly also. You're not sitting here, you're owning it, but you're not boastful, and you're not you're extremely relatable, which is very powerful. But
I do
thank
both
you.
Sometimes.
Well, you need to be able to own it.
When someone tries to put me down, I will actually.
Does
then,
that happen?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Men do it. So I will get emails from men recommending what I should read or how I should speak properly. And in their moments, I will then actually list my achievements and say, I'm a best-selling author. I'm a PhD from Trinity. I published in Nature. I have the biggest grant in academic history for widening participation. Go fuck yourself. So don't fuck with me is basically what I say. I'm modest until you fuck with me.
What a way to end the conversation.
Thank you.
Oh, it's like mic drop.
Yes.
Katrina's book is called Poor and it is incredible. Thank you so much, as always, for listening to Ready to Be Real.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.